Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 355, recorded for December 16th, 2025. EKS Network Policies, now with more layers on your security team's org chart. Good evening, Ryan. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing well as well. You know, we're all turning into pumpkins here as the Christmas holidays rapidly approach.
Indeed.
So this is our last episode that'll publish this year. And then we will drop in January our, you know, year-end look back and our look ahead predictions and see how we did on predictions last year. That'll be our first show back into the new year. But we're taking off next week for Christmas because we've realized trying to do Christmas shows is just bad.
No, yeah.
It doesn't work. So, and plus after reInvent, we're tired and we want to go do other things. So we will definitely have to follow up on a couple things when we get back, but definitely look forward to the new year and new year in cloud. Maybe less AI. Probably not. Probably more AI. It's really how it's going to work.
Yeah.
And on that note, let's get into it, shall we?
Yeah.
So Meta is apparently developing Avocado, their new frontier AI model codenamed to succeed Llama, now expected to launch in 2026 in Q1. After internal delays related to training performance and testing, the model may be proprietary rather than open source, making a significant shift from Meta's previous strategy to freely distribute Llama's weights and architecture to developers. Meta has spent apparently $14.3 billion since June to hire Scale AI founder Alexander Wang and acquire a stake in Scale. Company has apparently restructured AI leadership after Llama 4's poor reception in April, with the chief product officer Chris Cox no longer overseeing the general AI unit. And Meta cut 600 jobs in the superintelligence labs in October. So their strategy is get rid of open source, go make it proprietary, and we'll be successful. That's a weird choice. I don't know. I kind of feel like that was what their value prop was that they were open source, because a model built on Facebook data and Instagram is either probably very racist or full of thirst traps. I'm not really sure how that works out in the model, but I just don't know if it's a really interesting, compelling story for them.
Yeah, I was very surprised by the proprietary of it, and I'm just not sure. Like, I guess I don't really understand the business of, you know, the AI models. Like, I guess if you are going to, you know, offer like a chat service or that kind of thing, you have to sort of have a proprietary model, I guess. But it's kind of strange.
Yeah. So anyways, we'll keep an eye on that, see what they do if they actually release a new proprietary model in Q1. But apparently this is causing a lot of rifts inside their culture. So see how that continues to evolve as they try to become a big player in AI. Hopefully better than their story in AR, VR. And the metaverse.
Yes. If we will. Yes, hopefully.
Disney has apparently sued Google AI for infringing copyright on a massive scale, they allege. They issued a cease and desist letter to Google alleging copyright infringement through its generative AI models, claiming Google trained its systems on Disney's copyrighted content without authorization and now enables users to generate Disney-owned characters like those from The Lion King, Deadpool, and Star Wars, which represents one of the first major legal challenges from a content owner with substantial legal resources against a cloud AI provider. Legal notice targets two specific violations: Google's use of Disney's copyrighted works and training data for its image and video generation models, and the distribution of Disney character reproductions to end users through AI-generated outputs. The case could establish important precedents for how cloud providers handle copyrighted training data and implement content filtering in AI services. The outcome may force cloud AI platforms to develop more sophisticated copyright detection systems or negotiate license agreements with content owners before deploying generative AI. Disney's involvement brings considerable legal firepower to the battle, and so we'll see how this one goes next year, I'm sure. It'll get to court.
Yeah. Disney suing for copyright infringement. Shocking.
Shocking. The biggest abuser of copyright out there. Not violating it, but making it last as long as possible for Mickey Mouse.
Right.
So.
Well, and then they are just renowned for being completely evil.
Yes.
For anyone, like, you know, really sticking to like parody standards for people making fun of Mickey Mouse or all kinds of things like that. Just any reference. So it does make sense if there's going to be a major like AI case that sort of sets the precedent what's okay and what's not for AI. It does make sense. It'll be brought by Disney.
Yeah. Sort of weird timing though, don't you think? You know, why in December of all time? And then this story comes across my desk. Disney is investing $1 billion in OpenAI and has licensed 200 characters for its AI video app, Sora. Oh, okay.
All right.
So this is apparently marking the first major Hollywood studio content licensing deal for OpenAI's video platform, which launched in late September and faced industry criticism over copyright concerns. The three-year license agreement allows Sora to users to create short video clips featuring licensed Disney characters, representing a shift from OpenAI's previous approach of training models on copyrighted material without permission. This deal is notable given Disney's history of aggressive copyright protection and the lobbying that shaped modern U.S. copyright law in the 1990s. OpenAI has been pursuing content licensing deals with major IP holders after facing multiple lawsuits over unauthorized use of copyright training data. And I'm sure that, you know, didn't help that, or didn't hurt that they would go sue the biggest competitor of theirs right at the same time. So that's just super convenient. But it's sort of weird. It's like, well, so OpenAI is licensing these characters, but then Disney's investing $1 billion. So is that like a, well, Disney wanted $2 billion, but we gave them an, you know, or they wanted to charge us more, but we gave them a discount because they're an investor or something. I don't know. It's a weird worded story.
I mean, it's business relationships are never as straightforward. As I've learned more about the business, you know, growing older, I guess. And so it's like all these little sort of hooks and trying to, you know, leverage each other for shared success in theory. It's kind of funny. But, or is it just a way to like get out of the lawsuit so that they can generate the content? I don't know. It's a weird product differentiator, if that's the case.
It is, yeah. I mean, I don't, is Sora even a thing anymore? Remember, it was kind of had like a big moment of everyone using it. And then I feel like it kind of died off pretty quickly because it was so bad in so many ways. I mean, I don't know. Do your kids like Sora?
There's like little tools and little like websites and stuff where it sort of comes into play, but it does seem like it's sort of lost its luster. It's no longer shiny and new.
Yeah. And I see that Sora watermark on a video. I'm just kind of like, I swipe on by. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, whatever. Yeah. Don't care. Well, OpenAI, as we know, is in the crunch mode, trying to deal with the existential threat brought on by Gemini. And so they released two new models for us this week. First is the release of GPT Image 1.5, their new flagship image generation model now available in ChatGPT for all users and via the API. The model generates images up to 4x faster than the previous version and includes a dedicated images feature in the ChatGPT sidebar with preset filters and prompts for quick exploration. It's very competitive against Nano Banana, and I was looking at some of the charts. It's already jumped to the top of the charts in all image modifications, just slightly above Nano Banana.
Wow. The image generation of AI has gone a long way in a short period of time. So it's, I was pretty surprised with Nano Banana fixing some of the horribleness that experienced in early days of Planner with it. So it's play around with this and see if it's the same thing. I'm really happy to see that it also has improvements for text rendering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, definitely the text in images has gotten significantly better on all the models. Thank goodness.
Yeah. I didn't realize how much I generated images with text in it, but
It happens a lot.
It's very high.
Well, the nice thing is too, in some of them, you can now click in the image like, oh, I don't want this part. And so that helps the model actually like do the edits you want now. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely some nice improvements coming into image editing in general.
Yeah.
Well, if you don't care about images, but you care about ChatGPT and overall LLM performance, they've released GPT 5.2, now generally available for paid users and via the API as GPT-5.2 in the API, with three variants, including Instant for everyday tasks, Thinking for complex work, and Pro for highest quality outputs. Model introduces native spreadsheet and presentation generation capabilities of ChatGPT Enterprise, users reporting 40 to 60 minutes saved daily on average. So apparently all the funding decks they had to build were getting old and they just wanted the AI to do it for them. GPT 5.2 Thinking achieves a 70.9 win rate against human experts on GDP-Val benchmark spanning 44 occupations and set new records on Software Bench Pro at 55.6. The model demonstrates 11x faster output generation and less than 1% of the cost of expert professionals on knowledge work tasks. Long context performance reaches near 100% accuracy on forward needle MRCR variant up to 256,000 tokens. The new response compact endpoint extending effective context window for tool heavy workloads. API pricing set for $1.75 per million input tokens and 14 per million output tokens with 9% discount on cached inputs. Model introduces improved safety features, including strengthened responses for mental health and self-harm scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to see the improved safety features, because that's just coming to, you know, the news recently, and definitely, and some high profile sort of events happen where it's becoming a concern for sure. So it's I want to see more, you know, protections there and more in that space across all the providers. But I'm still very dubious of a new model from OpenAI right now, just because the last few models that they've released have just been almost unusable for my day to day.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely, the fact they felt they were under threat from Gemini was because they were.
Yeah.
And they were definitely hurting in general. So definitely interesting developments as well. All right, let's move on to some cloud tool news. Amazon is open sourcing Cedar it's already open source, but now it's joining the CNCF as a sandbox project, solving the problem of hard-coded access control by letting developers define fine-grained permissions as policies separate from the application code, supporting RBAC, ABAC, and REBAC models with fast real-time evaluations. The language stands out for its formal verification using the Lean Theorem Prover, and differential random testing as a specification, providing mathematical guarantees for security-critical authorization logic. Production adoption has been strong, with users including Cloudflare, MongoDB, AWS Bedrock, and Kubernetes integrations like Kubernetes Cedar Authorizer. The CNCF moved provider vendor neutral governance and broader community access beyond the AWS stewardship. And I'm sure this is really the key to why you do this. You want Google and Azure to adopt it, in addition to the other companies that didn't really care as much.
Mm-hmm.
About that lock-in, but if you make it part of the CNCF, now you can push it to become a standard and become part of the larger ecosystem, which would be great, because if you could have the same Cedar type controls across all three cloud providers, then you can make policies that actually reference certain things across those providers, which would be really cool.
And I think this type of policy is going to be absolutely key to managing sort of permissions going forward. I mean, there's already such a problem and constraint in allowing AI agents, you know, if you think about a cloud role, cloud permissions, like it's not as easy to define sort of what an AI agent can do and can't do. And I think it's going to change a lot. And so policy evaluation is probably going to be very important when it comes to those things. And I'm happy for Cedar to be more prevalent, because I like it better than Rego and open policy agents.
Yeah, I definitely like it better than OPA. So yeah, I'm with you right there. So. All right, moving on to general AWS news. GuardDuty Extended Threat Detection now identifies a coordinated crypto mining campaign starting from November 2nd, 2025, where attackers use compromised IAM credentials to deploy miners across EC2 and ECS within 10 minutes of the initial access. New attack sequence. Compromised instance group finding correlated signals across multiple data sources to detect sophisticated attack pattern, demonstrating how extended threat detection capabilities launched at reInvent in 2025 can identify coordinated campaigns. Attackers employed a novel persistent technique using modify instance attribute to disable API termination on all launched instances, forcing victims to manually re-enable termination before cleanup and disrupting automated remediation workflows. They also created public Lambda endpoints without authentication and established backdoor IAM users with SES permissions, showing advancement in crypto mining persistence methodologies behind typical mining operations. Campaign targeted high-value GPU and ML instances through auto-scaling groups configured to scale from 20 to 1,000 instances. The attackers first using dry run flags to validate permissions without triggering costs. The malicious Docker Hub image yannick65958/secret accumulated over 100,000 polls before takedown, and attackers create up to 50 ECS clusters per account with Fargate tasks configured for maximum CPU allocation of 16,384 units. AWS recommends enabling GuardDuty runtime monitoring alongside the foundational production plan for comprehensive coverage, as runtime monitoring provides host-level signals critical for extended threat detection correlation. So yeah, this new thing they announced, you should use it, because it sounds pretty darn good.
Yeah, I mean, it's like just the sophistication of these attacks. It's just so much more than, you know, the old school days of like you accidentally check in your credentials and someone's going to launch EC2 and just have it run, and it runs for however long until you find it. Like, it's the fact that they're creating artifacts and that you can later then exploit and call the websites in order to get back into the account. And, you know, especially disabling the termination, that's rough, right? Like, that's, mm-hmm. Right? 'Cause that's one of those things that you don't really know, you know, like that's a deep feature, right? Like that.
Well, it's like one of the other hacks I've heard about in the past is you change the encryption key for CloudTrail to, or for, CloudTrail, right? That's the overall audit mechanism.
Yeah, that's the overall log. Yeah.
Thank you. It's been a rough week.
Yeah.
So CloudTrail, you basically use a different encryption key for a different account. Use that to encrypt it. But since the encryption key is another account, you can't actually now access your own logs. But it doesn't trigger if you'd like turned off CloudTrail logs. So just changing the key was a pretty sophisticated hack. I need to fix that.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay. So yeah, kind of removes it as a signal.
Yeah. So basically, we're still logging CloudTrail, but yeah, you can't read the data and it's not actually providing any value because you don't have the decryption key to decrypt it. So yeah, that's hackers are the same tools we do for development, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we saw early days of AI as well, is that, you know, all of a sudden all of the telltale ways you identified phishing, you know, typos and weird, you know, language and images that don't look right is all gone because the AI just does it so beautifully well now for them.
Yep.
Amazon EKS is now supporting admin network policies and application network policies, giving cluster administrators centralized control over network security across all namespaces, while allowing namespace administrators to filter outbound traffic using domain names instead of maintaining IP address lists. This addresses a key limitation of standard Kubernetes network policies, which only work with individual namespaces and lack explicit deny rules or policy hierarchies. The new admin network policies operate in two tiers: admin tier rules that cannot be overridden by developers, and baseline tier rules that provide default connectivity but can be overridden by standard network policies. This enables platforms for teams to enforce cluster-wide security requirements like isolating sensitive workloads or ensuring monitoring access while still giving application teams flexibility within the boundary. Application network policies exclusive to EKS auto mode clusters add layer 7 fully qualified domain-based filtering, traditional layer 3 or 4 networking policies, solving the problem of managing egress to external services with frequently changing IP addresses, like the cloud. Instead of maintaining IP lists for SaaS providers or on-premise resources behind load balancers, teams can simply whitelist domain names like internal-api.companyname, and policies remain valid even when underlying IP addresses change. Requirements include Kubernetes 1.29 or later, Amazon VPC CNI driver version 1.21 or newer, for standard EKS clusters, and EKS auto mode for the application network policy with DNS filtering capability.
Yeah, this is one of those things that, you know, it's showing a maturity level of container-driven applications, just because it's been, I think, you know, a while since security teams have been aware of like some of the things that you can do with network policies and routing. And so it's been, you know, and you want to empower your developers and have that, but then being able to sort of also be able to sort of have a comprehensive, you know, ability to sort of ban and approve traffic has been missing from a lot of these, you know, basically ingress controllers. And so this is this is a great thing for security teams and probably going to be the terrible thing for developers who have had a little bit more free rein and have been able to develop a little bit more freely for networks. But we'll see. I mean, I've always been very conflicted about what you can do with ingress and Kubernetes in general. So.
You've always been conflicted about Kubernetes, period.
Yeah, Kubernetes completely. Yeah, and this is just one of those things that we're watching it turn into what the old controls were for that were firewall based and at the network level. And so it's going to be one of those things where we have to figure out what the balance is between those protections and the flexibility, and that doesn't change depending on the technology that's actually doing the protection. So it's you just move the problem around to Kubernetes and now it's being moved around more. So, yeah.
Well, if you've ever had to support any amount of developers in production for the ECS and EKS, one of the biggest banes of your existence will probably be troubleshooting dump analysis of your container. And so, you know, it always becomes a problem because the devs want to be able to connect their debuggers to the container and do the things. And none of that really works well in a containerized work environment, despite things like ECS Connect and other tools like that. So AWS is actually trying to solve that problem by giving you automated Java thread dump analysis solution that combines Prometheus monitoring, Grafana alerting, Lambda orchestration, and Amazon Bedrock AI to diagnose JVM performance issues in seconds rather than in hours. System works across both ECS and EKS environments, automatically detecting high thread counts and generating actionable insights without requiring deep JVM expertise from operations teams. I mean, I don't have to know how to do that anymore.
Does anyone have deep JVM experience anymore?
Right. The solution uses Spring Boot actuator endpoints for ECS deployments and Kubernetes API commands for EKS to capture thread dumps when Grafana alerts trigger. And Amazon Bedrock then analyzes the dumps to identify deadlocks, performance bottlenecks, and thread states while providing structured recommendations across six key areas, including executive summary and optimization guidance. Deployments is handled through a CloudFormation template available in the Java on AWS Immersion Day workshop, The all-thread dumps and AI analysis reports automatically stored in S3 for historical trending. The architecture follows event-driven principles with modular components that can be extended to other diagnostic tools like heap dump analysis or automated remediation workflows. The system enriches JVM metrics with contextual tags, including cluster identification and container metadata, enabling the Lambda function to determine the appropriate thread dump collection method. And this metadata-driven approach allows a single solution to handle heterogeneous container environments without manual configuration for each deployment type. Pricing follows standard AWS service costs for Lambda invocations, Bedrock LLM usage per token, S3 storage, and CloudWatch metrics, which tells me that if you have a bad container that crashes a lot, that you could spend a lot of money in LLM usage for tokens analyzing your exact same crash dump every time. So
yeah.
Do keep that in mind. And we want to enable this.
Is it automate? I mean, I don't know. I guess it is. I mean, it's. I don't know if it's automatically launched, but it's definitely like once you kick it off.
I mean, they do it off of a Grafana trigger. So that's you know, the Grafana alerts on the dump and it kicks off the basically the process, I think.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so, it could be just that it dumps it into S3 and doesn't do the analysis. I don't know. But it's definitely one of the things that like AI, like, sweet Jesus, something thread dump analysis. Like I've always hated it. Like, and
it's one of those, like, you have to do it, but it sucks. Mm-hmm. Because, and there's so much complexity. And then you have to understand the code line that you're actually generating the dump, and you have to have all this context. And so typically it depends on support operations guy who doesn't have the context and just trying to figure it out.
Yeah. And he's just the middleman.
Yeah. So it's a terrible thingless job that AI can definitely do better than I can.
Yeah.
And even in my own work, when I get thread dumps now, I'm just like, yeah, I got this thread dump. And I'm like, and even there's some times where I've been looking at it, I'm like, I'm not sure what's wrong, actually. Then like it analyzes, goes like, oh, this is very clearly an obvious thing. And I'm like,
okay, yeah.
Did not connect those dots right away like you did. So good job.
Yeah, it is really, I find it really powerful. I mean, I've never really felt great at analyzing thread dumps, but it is really nice to just have a solution that just tells me what's wrong, because that's all I've wanted the entire time. And it turns out it's garbage collection. It's just always garbage. If you don't have your garbage collection tuned right, your app doesn't work.
EC2 auto-scaling now offers a synchronous API to launch instances inside an auto-scaling group. This provides synchronous feedback when launching instances, allowing customers to immediately know if capacity is available in their specified availability zone or subnet. Suggests the scenarios where customers need precise control over instance placement and real-time confirmation of scaling operations rather than waiting for the asynchronous results. Which, if you've ever updated an auto-scaling group and you're waiting for it to do a refresh, this is a great feature for you, because this allows you to be much more particular about how you want to do things. The API enables customers to override default auto-scaling group configurations by specifying exact availability zones and subnets for new instances, while still maintaining the benefit of automated fleet management like health checks and scaling policies. The feature is partially useful for workloads that require strict placement constraints or need to implement fallback strategies quickly when capacity constraints occur in a specific zone, which happens a lot more now that AI is using all the spot capacity. Oh. So overall, nice little feature here that I've always sort of wanted.
Do you like this one? I find that, you know, like the auto scaling and the things that, you know, that it's basically allowing you to tune are all the things that I moved to auto scaling for, right? I don't want to deal with any of this nonsense. And so you still have to maintain your own sort of orchestration that understands which zone and that kind of, you know, that you need to roll out to. So, because it's going to have to call that API.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's definitely times when I wanted it. Mm. I don't think I use it all the time, but I definitely would have appreciated it in certain scenarios. Mm. So,
I mean, I'm always happy for another knob, that's for sure. But
yeah. AWS is now enabling cost allocation based on workforce user attributes like the cost center, division, and department imported from IAM Identity Center. This allows organizations to automatically tag per-user subscription and on-demand fees for services like Amazon Q Business, Q Developer, and QuickSight with organizational metadata for chargeback purposes. The feature addresses a common FinOps challenge where companies struggle to attribute SaaS-style AWS application costs back to specific business units, and once user attributes are imported to IAM Identity Center and enabled as cost allocation tags in Billing Console, usage automatically flows to Cost Explorer and CUR 2.0 with the appropriate organizational tags attached. This capability is particularly relevant for enterprises deploying Amazon Q Business or QuickSight at scale, where individual user subscriptions can quickly add up across departments instead of manually tracking which users belong to which cost centers. I mean, in general, even I get why they matters for Q Business or QuickSight or those things, but also just the ability to be able to create rules based on this data in IAM Identity Center. So as you create new instances, you can automatically populate this data. There's lots of use cases where this gets interesting real quickly. And this is a really nice feature that I'm very happy about.
Yeah. And you know, how neat would it be to have, you know, things automatically tagged rather than just on policy that has to be predefined and hopefully encapsulates every business rule you need, to just having even compute resources or individual resources in the cloud be automatically tagged based off of, you know, someone accessing it or deploying it or who knows. It's kind of neat. I like this. I like this model. I hope it sort of takes off.
Yeah. I hope it takes off too, because it has a ton of value in a lot of use cases. So.
It is going to highlight like me going, because I'm, you know, typically I ask a lot of questions of data, and especially in like a BI program. So like, what is this? And I'm constantly looking at things and filtering things. And now that AI is a thing, I'm just asking it questions all the time. And so like, that's going to be a problem because I'm going to be called out. So I'm like, I'm expensive.
Moving on to GCP. They're looking at OpenAI and saying, yeah, catch me, biatch.
Yeah.
They released Gemini 3 Flash and Gemini 3 Flash for Enterprises this week. The Gemini 3 Flash positions it as a frontier intelligence model optimized for speed at reduced cost. The model processes over 1 trillion tokens daily through Google's API and replaces Gemini 2.5 Flash as the default model in the Gemini app globally at no cost to users. I mean, this is just in general is a pretty big improvement from, you know, not only the cost perspective, but also the overall performance and the ability to run this on local devices for like Android phones is going to be a huge breakthrough in LLM performance on device. So I suspect you'll see a lot of Gemini 3 Flash getting rolled out all over the place because it does a lot of things really darn well.
Yeah, no, and it's, you know, the being able to run these smaller models is becoming at least more important and visible to me as it's becoming more ubiquitous, you know, on little things here and there that I'm using AI for. So it's not everything has to, it's going to have like a supercomputer behind it and you want quicker results. So that's kind of neat. You know, I still don't really understand any of the, you know, performance metrics that they use on these things, but, you know, looks like better numbers, so good.
I mean, you had to go look at all the benchmarks and how the benchmarks work, and I tried to read through some of them, and I can tell you they're dense. They make sense, but they're involved. And they all have different idiosyncrasies to them, just like any other benchmark does for CPUs. Google has integrated Model Context Protocol servers into its new anti-gravity IDE, allowing AI agents to directly connect to Google Cloud data services, including AlloyDB, BigQuery, Spanner, Cloud SQL, and Looker. The MCP toolbox for databases provides pre-built connectors that eliminate manual configuration, letting developers access enterprise data through a UI-driven setup process within the IDE. The integration enables AI agents to perform, BigQuery and Looker connects extend agent capabilities into analytics and business intelligence workflows, and agents can forecast trends, search data catalogs, validate metric definitions against semantic models, and run ad hoc queries to ensure application logic matches production reporting standards. MCP servers use IAM credentials to secure password storage, maintain security while giving agents access to production data sources. And this all leads into the fact that Google has now officially provided fully managed remote MCP protocol servers that are plugging into anti-gravity. So not only if you use anti-gravity, you get this capability, but you also get this capability through the officially supported Google MCP servers for anything that talks to MCPs. So in general, very, very happy with that.
Yeah, no, it's kind of, it's interesting. It's interesting that they're rolling this out as part of their IDE. I guess, you know, like where else are you going to put an MCP, you know, sort of connection? But I'm always, you know, like there's a lot of IDEs, and I'm definitely not one to use like specific IDEs for specific products anymore. So like, I feel like that's an older model. But
I did download this IDE that I've never heard of until this week.
Well, it's new, right? And, I thought it was new.
Yeah, I mean, it's newish, anti-gravity. And so I'm curious to play with it. I'm not super interested in moving off of my tried and true Visual Studio Code that I've used forever now. But I'm always willing to try a new IDE out once. That's how I got to Visual Studio Code in the first place, because I used other tools before that one.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely interesting. But in addition to, you know, all of the Google Cloud direct stuff in the MCP, you also get access to things like the Google Maps platform for location grounding, which is pretty nice. So even some of the SaaS applications are getting you something as well. And then if you're like, well, MCPs are great, but I really could use it in Apigee, you can also get Apigee support inside for MCP, allowing organizations to expose their existing APIs as tools for AI agents without writing code or managing the MCP server itself. And Google handling the infrastructure transcoding and protocol management, while Apigee build applies its 30+ built-in policies for authorization, authentication, and security to govern agentic interactions. So a lot of MCP love today in the Google Cloud world, all integrated, of course, into the ADK, the MCP proxies, and the security capabilities of Apigee.
I just did some real-time analysis about the, you know, the feature of the MCP and then also the browser and stuff. It's one of those things where it is the newer model of like of coding where you're having distributed agents do tasks and that. And so like the new IDEs are sort of taking care of or taking advantage of that. And it is a VS Code fork. So it's very comfortable to, you know, your VS Code users. So
just like a VS Code or a Cursor.
Yep, you know, exactly.
Sorry, Cursor. I see import from VS. I just happened to open it. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I installed that earlier. And I didn't actually run it. And so I did hit that when you were talking about it. And I do see it's like import all your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you want to use your agents, et cetera. So yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Makes sense.
Everyone's just using VS Code. That's the,
yep.
the new, it's like everyone uses the Chrome engine now for their browser.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Google's Application Design Center has now reached general availability as a visual AI-powered platform for designing and deploying Terraform-backed application infrastructure on GCP. Serves integrates the Gemini Cloud Assist to let users describe infrastructure needs in natural language and receive deployable architecture diagrams with Terraform code while automatically registering applications with App Hub for unified management. The platform addresses platform engineering needs by providing a curated catalog of opinionated application templates, including specialized GKE templates for AI inference workloads using various LLM models. Organizations can bring their own Terraform configurations from Git repositories and combine them with Google-provided components to create standardized infrastructure patterns for reuse across development environments. The GAA features include public APIs and gCloud CLI support, VPC service control compatibility, and GitOps integration for CI/CD workflows. Service offers application template revisions as an immutable audit trail and automatically detects configuration drift between intended design and deployed applications to maintain compliance. The VAP platform is available free of cost for building and deploying application templates with pricing details at the website in the show notes. That's a pretty nice one.
Yeah, it's kind of the Pangea that everyone's been hoping for a long time, and with technology, I guess AI is making it possible. Just be able to, you know, plain text speak your infrastructure into existence versus having to know, you know, specific HCL language and how to call it and doing all the research of which modules are available and linking it all together. That's
interesting to play with this. I'm definitely gonna take a note to follow up on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely like this model better than like the, you know, like the Beanstalk or you know, the sort of hosted application model, which has kind of been the solution up until this, right? Is, you know, you don't have the infrastructure expertise in order to make these things work, so you use a hosted platform. This is sort of the answer I want, which is I don't really want to create a whole bunch of, you know, underlying infrastructure configuration and maintain it into existence if I don't have to. But I do want the flexibility and the certainty that it does provide having it, you know, templated and something that I can apply policy against and review.
That's very cool. And in Azure world, if you are familiar with Kerberos and the curse of Kerberos, you probably are very familiar with Windows RC4-based authentication requests and the risk of such things. And Microsoft is finally killing and deprecating RC4 encryption, only after 26 years of default support, following its role in major breaches, including the 2024 Ascension healthcare attack that affected 5.6 million patient records. Cypher has been cryptographically weak since 1994, enabled Kerberos roasting attacks that have been compromising enterprise networks for over a decade. Windows servers have continued to accept RC4-based authentication requests by default even after AES support was added, creating a persistent attack vector that hackers routinely exploited. Senator Ron Wyden called for the FTC investigation of Microsoft in September for gross cybersecurity negligence related to this default configuration. Deprecation addresses a fundamental security gap in Enterprise Identity Manager that has existed since Active Directory launched in 2000, and organizations using Windows authentication will need to ensure their systems are configured to use AES encryption and disable the RC4 fallback to prevent downgrade attacks. This change affects any organization running Active Directory for user auth and access control, including those in healthcare, finance, and other regulated industries, or really anybody who uses Windows.
Yeah.
I mean, like, this has been such a problem for so long.
Yeah.
So about time. Thanks, Senator Ron Wyden, for, you know, gross negligence claims against Microsoft.
I mean, finally, if that's what it takes to motivate them, that's not great. Literally an act of Congress, right? No, well, act of Senate.
Literally.
It's AD is so complex and it's hard to get running in the beginning that almost everyone just sort of accepts the defaults to get it up and going. And then this is one of those things that, you know, if you don't know how compromised that this cipher is, you don't really prioritize getting back to it and fixing the ciphers that are used in the encryption. And it's so, like, I'm really happy to see this. It's always been sort of this weird, like, black mark that makes me not trust, you know, Windows in general.
This is the problem with, you know, not being secure by default. And the challenge, I think, you know, even when they supported like TLS 1.2, they would accept TLS 1.0 first.
Yeah.
And so to disable that, you'd have to go turn it off in the registry and all these things. It's like, no, it's like, why don't you fall back to the less secure ones versus the other way around? Then it becomes an opt-in versus an opt-out.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons why people always said Windows was less secure and all that. So it's good. But yeah, to have a senator shame you into this is kind of sad. So, well, Azure last week saw, you know, S3 got 50 terabit bucket support. And so they've also announced Azure Blob Storage will now scale to exabytes with 50 plus terabit per second throughput and millions of IOPS, specifically architecting to keep GPUs continuously fed during AI training workloads. The platform powers OpenAI's model training and includes new smart tier preview. Bobahim moves data between hot, cool, and cold tiers based on 30 to 90 day access patterns. Azure UltraDisk delivers new sub 0.5 milliseconds latency with 30% improvement on Azure Boost VM, scaling to 400,000 IOPS per disk and up to 800,000 IOPS per VM on new EBS v6 instances. And the new Instant Access Snapshots preview eliminates pre-warming requirements and reduces recovery times from hours to seconds for premium SDV2 and UltraDisk. Azure Managed Lustre AMLFS 2.0 preview supports 25 petabit namespaces and 512 gigabits of throughput, featuring auto import and auto export capabilities. And Azure Files introduces Entra-only identity support for SMB shares, eliminating the need for on-premise AD infrastructure and enabling cloud-native identity management, including external identities for Azure Virtual Desktop. And the Storage Mover adds cloud-to-cloud transfers and on-premise NFS to Azure Files migration capabilities. Wow, that's a lot of good stuff.
It just dawned on me as you're reading through here, because I was like, this is, you know, interesting. Getting all this high performance from, you know, object stores just sort of blows my mind. And then I realized that, you know, like all these sort of cloud file systems, quote unquote, have been backed underneath by these object stores for a long time. Like, oh, of course they need this. Like,
yes, of course they do.
Because I was wondering why they were talking about, you know, the Azure Managed Lustre and these things that are file system based in this.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, wait a sec. Oh, you have to have the large object store in order to provide the file systems on top of it.
Uh-huh.
Which, because I've always wondered how people were using object store and like high perform, like how do you use a 50 terabyte blob? You know, I'm like, I don't know how you do that. I'm like, now I do. Like, you don't directly.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't directly. That's, well, I mean, even when they first launched EBS, it was all, everyone kind of knew that it was built on top of S3, but you know, how it was done, people were like, I don't really know how that works.
Oh,
like,
we understood it questions. Was on EBS and the performance really told you that it didn't. It
yeah. Like it wasn't great. We knew.
At the beginning,
but,
yeah.
Yeah.
it's pretty good now. Right. But that's, it is interesting. And it's just funny. I'm just like, my eyes are opened all of a sudden.
Well, the insatiable thirst for power and AI supremacy is driving Microsoft to expand its U.S. data center footprint with a new U.S. East 3 region launching in Greater Atlanta in early 2027, plus adding availability zones to 5 existing regions by the end of 2027. The Atlanta region will support advanced AI workloads and features zone-redundant storage for improved application resilience designed to meet LEED Gold Standard certifications for sustainability. Expansions adding those availability zones to the North Central U.S., West Central U.S., and U.S. Gov Arizona regions, plus enhances existing zones in U.S. East 2, Virginia, and South Central U.S. Texas. Azure government customers get dedicated infrastructure expansion with 3 availability zones coming to the U.S. Gov Arizona in early 2026, specifically supporting defense industrial-based requirements. And this is all represents a pretty large infrastructure investment to support organizations like the University of Miami, using availability zones for disaster recovery in hurricane-prone regions, and many, many other use cases that they highlight in their article.
Yeah, I mean, it's AI is definitely driving a lot of this, right? Just good space in general, but then also like large data sets, you don't really want to have that distributed globally. So it's,
right.
And so that is sort of a trick, but then I also think they're just purely running out of space, you know, or so kind of nuts. But in government's probably adopting computer and cloud providers like crazy. So yeah, instead of maintaining their own sort of private data centers and doing that, taking advantage of these cloud hyperscalers. That's cool.
Well, and if you have all those data centers and you have all that storage moving around at all that speed, you need to also upgrade your networking. And so Azure is tripling down on AI infrastructure with its global network, now reaching 18 petabits per second of total capacity, up from 6 petabytes a second at the end of FY24. So 3x the size in 2 years. The network spans over 60 AI regions with 500,000 miles of fiber and 4 petabytes of WAN capacity, using InfiniBand and high-speed Ethernet for lossless data transfer between GPU clusters. NAT Gateway Standard V2 enters public preview with zone redundancy by default at no additional cost, delivering 100 gigabits per second throughput and 10 million packets per second. And this joins ExpressRoute, VPN, and Application Gateways in offering zone resilient SKUs as part of Azure's resiliency by default strategy. Security updates include DNS security policy with Threat Intel now generally available for blocking malicious domains, private link direct connects in preview for extending connectivity to any routable private IP, and JOT validation at layer 7 in Application Gateway to preview offload token validation from your backend servers. The ExpressRoute is getting a 400 gigabit direct port in select locations starting in 2026 for multi-terabit throughput, while VPN Gateway now generally available supports 5 gigabits of single TCP flow and 20 gigabits total throughput with 4 tunnels. Private link scales to 5,000 endpoints per VNet and 20,000 across peered VNets. And container network improvements for AKS include eBPF's host routing for lower latency, pod CIDR expansion without cluster redeployment, WAF for application gateway for containers now generally available, and Azure Bastion support for private AKS cluster access. That's a lot of networking stuff too.
Yeah, that's a great announcement. I mean, that's if you have those high network throughput needs, that's fantastic. And I, you know, it's been a while since I've really got into cloud at that deep layer, but I do remember sort of in AWS the VPN limitations really biting, you know, like certain connectivity things, because you really did hit, it was easy to hit those limits pretty fast, and you know, direct connect and other things came along and sort of fixed some of those things, but then I'm sure, you know, you can exceed those as well. I do like some of these, you know, things they tacked on, like the DNS, the automated sort of malicious domains. And that's kind of great because that's a great way to protect your environment so that your anything malicious, the outbound call just doesn't work, which is fantastic. I like to see those types of things. Very cool.
Well, Ryan, we made it.
Woohoo!
To the end of the show.
Yes, so. We have.
All right. Well, happy holidays to all of our listeners. And we will see you in the new year with our look back and look forward show. And hopefully the cloud providers take a little time off too, because they've been busy.
Yeah.
We cut a lot of stories this week that we, you know, Ryan, I didn't want to talk about, but really more just, you know, not anything super exciting, but lots of, I didn't make the reInvent cutoff type stories for AWS that they didn't make the cutoff for a reason.
Right.
But yeah, it's all good. So we look forward to seeing you in the new year, and have a great one, all of you.
Happy holidays, everybody.
And that's all for this week in cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Archera. Be sure to click the link in our show notes to learn more about their services. While you're at it, head over to our website at thecloudpod.net, where you can subscribe to our newsletter, join our Slack community, send us your feedback, and ask any questions you might have. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
Well, I do have an after show for you.
Oh.
That we had to talk about. So when I talked to you about Amazon Lambda and serverless and all of those things, is there a company that comes to mind for you that is a big poster child of using those type of technologies?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Roombas, right? Like that was was the big Lambda success story that their logo has been on many of my slide decks, toting serverless technologies and patterns.
Well, it might not be anymore.
Oh.
They've apparently filed for bankruptcy, marking the end of an era for the company that pioneered consumer robotics with the Roomba, now being acquired by its Chinese supplier, Pikia Robotics, after losing ground to cheaper competitors. The stock crashed from Amazon's $52 offer in 2023 to just $4.
Ouch.
Market leaders can fall when undercut on price. The failed Amazon acquisition in 2023 due to EU antitrust concerns looks particularly painful in hindsight, as iRobot might have been better off with Amazon's resources than facing bankruptcy. This highlights how regulatory decisions intend to preserve competition can sometimes accelerate a company's decline instead. And for cloud professionals, this demonstrates how hardware IoT companies struggle with strong cloud services and ecosystem lock-in that could justify premium pricing. iRobot's inability to differentiate beyond hardware shows why companies like Amazon, Google, and Apple integrate devices tightly with their cloud platforms. Chinese supplier takeover raises questions about data privacy and security for your millions of Roombas, so maybe it's time to retire them out to pasture if you're still using them. And this could become a cautionary tale about supply chain dependencies and what happens when your manufacturer becomes your new owner. In general, it was founded in 1990 and sold over 40 million robot devices. And this is kind of a sad day, especially if you're a big serverless fan, because they were definitely the poster child of all things serverless.
I forgot totally about the Amazon's bid on and that it failed. Because that's kind of nuts. Like it really does show that like the business was at least trying to sort of find a situation that they could have gotten out of. But they also did just have their lunch just eaten by, there's a billion competitors now, and they never were able to really keep up and stay ahead of the game competitively, right? Like that was sort of, and I don't, you know, like I don't think this is really a takedown of serverless or anything like that, because it really was sort of the combination of the hardware devices being sort of the same, you know, thinking about like Ecovac and some of these other competitors that I know more recently that have come through. The hardware was all just sort of basic and the same. They never really changed there. And then it was just, it was more expensive than anything else. Like that was it.
Yeah. I mean, it got, when they got up to like $800-$900 mm-hmm. for what they were able to do, it was sort of like, oof.
Yeah.
This is getting pretty expensive for kind of a mediocre product.
Yeah.
In some ways.
And I kind of didn't like some of the advancements, but like the newer vacuums and stuff are all vision based. And so like I vacuum in the middle of the night. And so I kind of liked the iRobot, the older ones, but then, you know, like, cause you don't have to have the lights on, but if you don't have the lights on, your house is particularly dark. Cause I don't like sunlight. Those things don't work at night.
I mean, you mentioned before the show that you don't sleep well at night. Maybe it's the vacuums. Maybe you shouldn't run those at night. I'm just putting it out there.
But, yeah. There's definitely, you know, I like my house to sort of like in the Jetsons, it sort of like resets overnight and like everything gets washed and everything. And I wake up during the day and it's like a brand new day.
It's interesting because I was just looking at, you know, Wirecutter, who last time I bought a robot vacuum, which was years ago now, you know, it was iRobot all the way. And now iRobot's not even on the list. Like their top pick is some company called Roborock, and their runner up pick is a company called Tapo. I've heard of neither of these companies.
I have not heard of Tapo. I've heard of Roborock.
I heard of Ecobee, and I knew of Narwhal only because I bought their mop because I was super excited about it. And their mop wasn't very good.
Yeah.
Either.
I tried buying it. It's in a closet now.
Yeah. Yeah. When we moved to this house here, we had the highest end iRobot that you could buy. And my house is a single story house and it's, like 3,400 square feet. And it couldn't keep the memory of the house in its memory.
Yeah.
It would basically fail somewhere randomly in the house. But I had to go hunt for it. Like, where did the robot die? And so that was what killed it here at this house. And so, you know, it's definitely sad that it's gone. And, but, you know, I definitely, when I was looking at buying another one, I was like, I'm not going to spend another $800 on a product that isn't really innovating and wasn't changing a lot. And so, you know, I definitely, if I was interested in replacing it, which I am not at the moment, I would definitely look probably elsewhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, which is why iRobot's filing bankruptcy, because you and I are having this conversation going, yeah, we wouldn't buy one right now either.
No. Like, and the $800, I'd rather buy like three cheap ones, you know, and have them just fight each other out at the boundaries, like robot to the death, but at least my floors would be clean. It gets really frustrating it was one thing when it got stuck under a chair or something mechanically where it couldn't get out. And you're like, okay, this is just silly, but it would just stop in the middle of the floor going, I don't know where I am. Like, I can't do it.
Yeah,
I can't do anything else. Like, what are you doing?
That's what happened to mine. Like, I would get a message saying, you know, unknown fault on my robot, Google the message, and you're like, oh, you the memory space ran out on the robot because the floor plan's too big.
Yeah,
and you're like, okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's how I figured out my mapping issues, because the maps kept resetting in the same way, and it was because it was too dark, so it would lose its. It didn't have enough data points to sort of say, oh, here I am in the map, and so it would be like, oh, I'm somewhere new, and it would just reset the whole thing. Like, so frustrating.
For sure. Well, Ben Kehoe was really one of the big reasons why I was really into iRobot as well. And he was such a strong advocate for all things, you know, Lambda. And so
big impact on
he's been gone for a while now.
Serverless.
I think that was our joke is like, you know, so they felt like, you know, you wouldn't apply to them directly. So they just had to buy your company when Amazon was going to buy them. And then that didn't come through.
Yeah.
I just looked at Mark. So I was curious what he's up to these days. He's over at Siemens. another PLC-based robotic company, so I'm sure he's having a good time.
We should
reach out to him someday and see what he's up to.
Mm-hmm.
But well, RIP, iRobot, if they don't survive, or, you know, I assume this new Chinese company will keep developing and maybe they'll bring the cost down and make it better. And I'll be curious if they still are a big Amazon customer or if they start changing their technology to be less dependent. So we'll see what happens. Alibaba Cloud.
It'll be an uphill battle in the US market because people hear the Chinese supplier and panic.
Yeah, maybe all those brands, Roborock and Ecovacs, and all those, I'm pretty sure they're all Chinese vendors too. Narwhal is for sure.
It cracks me up. It's the minute it gets branded as such, that's, you know.
Yeah, it's all over for it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, have a great Christmas.
All right, you
too. We'll see you in the new year.
All right.
Later.
Bye now.